Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 11th of March. Michigan and Florida, what to do with those delegates is our conversation the first hour of today's program. The Chicago Tribune had an interesting editorial yesterday talking about these decisions that were made to move up the primaries so early. And it goes partially like this. It's clear this election they're having is not going to count for anything. That was Senator Hillary Clinton on New Hampshire Public Radio dismissing the January 15 Michigan presidential primary. And the Tribune says that they don't recall much public protest in Michigan and Florida back when lawmakers were boasting that early primaries would give voters in those states more clout in the nominating process. Cutting favors for Michigan and Florida would cheat Democrats in all the other states who followed their national party's rules. We hope that doesn't happen, not because it would disadvantage Obama, this is a Chicago paper, but because picking presidents is serious business. People who defy the rules they helped write should accept the consequences of their actions. Hillary Clinton was correct in January. Michigan's primary should count for nothing. Florida's too. See you in 2012. But, of course, there is a big movement afoot to redo these primaries, and some prominent Democrats are thinking seriously about a mail-in election to resolve the dispute over the fate of delegates from Florida and Michigan. We're going to talk about all of that this hour and should have a rip-roaring good conversation with Professor Alexander Lamas, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. He is a specialist on elections and political parties, is the author of The Two-Party South, editor of Ohio Politics, author of Southern Politics in the 1990s. He's also taught at the University of North Florida and the University of Mississippi. They're having a primary, as you know, today, so we'll talk a wee bit about that during this hour. And he's worked as a research assistant at the Brookings Institution. Our phones on political topics during this phenomenally interesting year will be crowded. So here's the number. Call when you'd like. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Professor Lamas, hello. Thanks for joining us again.
Good morning.
Yeah. Well, so what about this idea, this suggestion, and it hasn't come from a whole lot of people, but in yesterday's Tribune, people who defy the rules they helped write should accept the consequences of their actions. Sorry, Florida. Sorry, Michigan.
Well, I think it'd be very difficult not to have Florida and Michigan delegations at the convention, and I think all the professionals understood that there would be delegations, but they thought that the delegations would not really matter because the nomination would be settled before the convention. And that, of course, has changed. It's still a question mark when the nomination will be settled.
It sure is a question mark, isn't it? It just goes on and on. What about this idea, this is the latest idea, that we should just have mail-in elections in both of these states? Is that a good idea?
Well, the officials in both states and Democratic national operatives are, you know, trying to come up with some way to let Michigan and Florida vote again. And so the mail-in option is being considered because it's less expensive than holding a full-scale primary. Oregon does elections by mail. In fact, they've perfected it after, you know, a long, you know, series of efforts. I think it took them 10 years to get it right.
Oh, my.
So I imagine there's some lessons there for Florida and Michigan if they go that route.
If it took Oregon 10 years to get it right, how are they going to get it right in a couple months?
Well, maybe there's, as I say, maybe there's some good lessons
that
they could learn. They could send a team out to Oregon. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if they aren't, you know, in consultation with Oregon right now.
Howard Dean has said that it's up to the state's Democrats to formulate a plan that both campaigns would support. Who are the people who are formulating those plans? Who are these Democrats?
Well, I think the two campaigns, Senator Obama's campaign, Senator Clinton's campaign, and then the officials in both states, and of course they would bring in the governmental structure, because there may be, you know, may be necessary for there to be a law passed quickly to allow these primaries.
And would this be the least expensive way to go, Professor Lamas?
Well, probably the easiest solution would be just, and this has been suggested by the Obama campaign, to just split the delegation 50-50,
mm-hmm.
and not have a revote. Of course, that wouldn't cost anything. But I guess the mail-in, you know, option would be the least expensive.
And they would have...
But this whole thing now is, of course, caught up in the struggle between the two candidates to come out on top. So they're going to scrutinize every proposal for benefit.
It seems to me as though they don't have a whole lot of time to get this together.
We have several months, but you know the last primary isn't until June, so there is time. You know, there's clearly time. In fact, that's one of the most amazing things about this whole primary season. You remember when we talked several months ago about the process and the flaws in the nomination process. One of the flaws that we discussed was that it ended so quickly in recent cycles, and many voters didn't have a chance to participate. And this was a serious problem, and it's led to a lot of people, including my wife and I, to make suggestions for drawing it out, allowing voters to participate. Well, as we see, this process is drawn out, and that's one good thing about it. A lot of voters in states that have never in recent years been a part of the process are getting a chance to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. The Clinton camp. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that, and because it's so drawn, that's why there is time to fix the Florida-Michigan situation.
I would think that this is a no-go as far as the Obama camp is concerned. But tell me why the Clinton campaign keeps talking about this strategy. They're saying that the results of the original contest in Michigan and Florida should count.
Senator Clinton came out on top in both of them, even though in one, in Michigan, Senator Obama wasn't on the ballot. He withdrew along with most of the other candidates under pressure from Iowa and New Hampshire. And in Florida, he was on the ballot. All of them were on the ballot. but Senator Clinton came out on top. Now, one reason she came out on top was because the great advantage she had throughout this process in the early months was that she was a well-known figure. And this is why a front-loaded nomination process is not fair to the full field of candidates, because it does favor those who are well-known. And what we saw in the early contest leading up to Super Tuesday was that when Senator Obama had a chance to campaign, he closed the gap very rapidly. In fact, in Florida, which, of course, didn't have a campaign, it's interesting to note from the exit polls that people who decided in the last month, based on what they told exit poll takers, predominantly sided with Senator Obama. Those who said they made up their mind over a month before the primary was held, and those who voted early, voted more for Senator Clinton, which suggests that whole process of the outsider closing the gap was going on even in Florida, where there was no campaign.
Mm-hmm. Well, why do you think it is that Michigan and Florida, knowing that there was only one candidate on the ballot in Michigan and that nobody was campaigning in Florida, why did they go ahead with these? Didn't they must have known they weren't going to count.
Well, it was a train wreck, really, ready to happen.
Right.
And it happened for reasons that, frankly, I'm amazed aren't getting more discussion in this whole period when we're trying to figure out what to do with Michigan and Florida. The reason they went ahead was because they thought that the sanctioning of states that went before the February 5th date for the official start of the process was wrong. That they thought that other states should have an opportunity of going first, and it's all part of this rush to be first that created the front loading problem in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
The Democratic Party opened it up a little bit instead of just allowing Iowa and New Hampshire to go first. On this cycle, they added two more states, South Carolina and Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't enough, you know, for Michigan and Florida. They said, look, we're big states. We have a lot of special interests that ought to be addressed by the candidates. We want an early campaign in our states, because if we wait, the whole process will be over based on this rush to decision that we've seen in these recent cycles. So that was the, you know, I mean, that was what it was all about. And it wasn't by accident that it was Michigan and Florida. The two senators from those states, Senator Levin and Senator Nelson of Florida, have introduced into Congress a piece of legislation that will revamp the process and eliminate the advantage that these early states of Iowa and New Hampshire have. And, you know, I don't know all the details of their plan, but in essence, it's a massive restructuring of the whole process.
Right. And is that a good thing? Should New Hampshire and Iowa have the kind of clout they have?
I don't think so. I mean, I give those states credit for allowing retail politics to allow, because they're in essence relatively small states. I mean, Iowa has, of course, more people than New Hampshire, but they both have traditions of retail politics, and that is a candidate can go there, spend a year like Jimmy Carter did in 1976, become known by the people, and if he has a good message. Presumably, you can offset the disadvantages that you would have as a basically obscure one-term governor of Georgia, as mm-hmm. was the case with Carter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good thing. But the fact that just those two states get to go first every time is not fair to the other 48 states.
Right.
And this is what has led to the, as I say, all of the states trying to go early and earlier until we had that massive event on Super Tuesday with 20-some-odd states voting.
Let's play what if. Not that it does us any good, but it's kind of fun. What if Michigan and Florida had gone when they were supposed to have gone? How would that have changed the way the race stands right now?
It's just hard to say, because, you know, the one thing that we've seen about Senator Obama is his campaign has realistically assessed what their disadvantages were, and looked hard at the process, and they've capitalized on every advantage that they could see for themselves. And, you know, that's one reason they focused on caucus states and gotten a lot of delegates out of caucus states. So if there had been an early Michigan primary, I am sure that his campaign would have run a stronger campaign there than you know, was actually run by the uncommitted slate
right.
that was on the ballot.
Hard to run a strong campaign
yeah.
in so, an uncommitted.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to say. And then Florida, of course, was 2 weeks later, so, you know, who knows what the dynamics of the race would have been then. And but it would have been, you know, I think it would have been more difficult for the lesser-known candidates, and I guess you could, you know, include some of the others in there who dropped out fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what effect it would have had on, you know, Senator Edwards, for example. I mean, he had a populist economic message that might have resonated in Michigan
mm-hmm.
and given him a boost, you know, going into South Carolina.
Why doesn't he endorse somebody?
I have no idea. That's a lot of people are asking that question.
Right.
And, I assume that coming a little later, you know, it might have more clout. I thought that, you know, before Ohio and Texas, but he didn't endorse then. So, you asked earlier, you know, who could bring this, you know, solution to the Michigan-Florida, you know, question. And, well, you know, people like Senator Edwards and former Vice President Gore and other, you know, very prominent national Democratic figures could step in at some point and say, you know, these are the kinds of things we should do to resolve this.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he's waiting to be part of that.
Oh, that's interesting. So they could do that? They could decide what's going to happen?
I don't think they could decide, but they could have an impact if they did it in mass, you know, and include, you know, former President Carter and some of the other others, even some of those who are committed to candidates. That would include, of course, Senator Mondale, who's behind Senator Clinton, and Senator Kerry, who's behind Senator Obama. And the big, you know, question, of course, that looms over this race is what role the superdelegates should have. you know, should the superdelegates go with the candidate who comes out of the fight for delegates on top, that is, has the most pledged delegates won in these primaries and caucuses, or should they possibly go against that verdict out of the process and pick someone else? Now, of course, Senator Obama is got a comfortable lead right now in the pledged delegates, and most people figuring it out with the remaining 11 states say that it's virtually impossible for Senator Clinton to catch him in the pledged category. So that would mean if the superdelegates decide they have to go with what the pledged delegate count is, that would mean Senator Obama becomes the nominee. Now, these notables could step in and say, yes, that's the way it should be, because really the superdelegates have not been selected by the people in 2008. You know, they got to be delegates through their positions in the party.
What does the party say about that? It seems to me as though there ought to be fairly clear rules about something that's so important. Shouldn't
well,
there
should be. And in fact, if you ask me, this notion that we have, this fact that we have nearly 20% of the delegates as being superdelegates is really outrageous. I mean, mm-hmm. it should not be that way. And frankly, the Republican Party, in my view, is a lot better on this. They have many fewer superdelegates. I think the percentage is about 6.5% of the delegates are so-called superdelegates, not selected through primaries or caucuses, whereas, you know, the Democrats have three times as many.
Right.
And that ought to be addressed in what I hope will come out of this whole process is a commission to reexamine the entire nomination process, because I think there are a lot of glaring flaws that we've seen throughout this process. And, you know, we've talked about a couple already.
And what about the popular vote? This is being discussed as well. What if he has more pledged delegates and she has more of the popular vote?
Well, you know, that there again, that the Council of Notables would have to take that into consideration.
The Council of Notables.
Yeah, more than likely, I mean, the candidate with the most pledged delegates, I think, is going to have the most, you know, popular votes, too. But, you know, we'll have to see.
Right.
But, you know, in the end, if there's no agreement, then you go to the convention, and it's the candidate with the most votes, you know. So that obviously, you know, puts the burden on the superdelegates who hold the balance. And, mm-hmm. and they shouldn't. It just really shouldn't be that way. You know, that article, that opinion piece that my wife Renee and I did, it was published in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette back in October, and I think it's still available online if any of your listeners are interested. But in that, we make some proposals for reform. But in an earlier version of that, a longer version that didn't get published. We talked about the superdelegates, and we called it, you know, really unconscionable to have such a large number of delegates who are not part of the selection process. That really isn't what the McGovern-Frazier reforms were trying to do after the 68th Democratic Convention. Their effort was to open up the process to see that popular sentiment among the participants would prevail.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there's so much pressure on the superdelegates to go with the popular result.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, frankly, I don't see how they can't do that. I mean, but they certainly are free under the rules to do that.
Right.
But it would really be a disaster.
I was struck by the comment, and I can't remember who said this, but when the Democrat won the Dennis Hastert seat in Illinois a couple days ago, which was a pretty big deal, the response wasn't, oh, we got another Democrat in Congress. It was, we got another superdelegate.
That's right. Well, in fact, I even heard the other day, and I haven't been able to check this out, but I heard that one reason the campaigns are so concerned about getting Michigan and Florida in the convention is not because of the edge they might have in pledged delegates through whatever process, but the fact that the superdelegates from those two states will then be seated. And more of the superdelegates are pledged to Senator Clinton.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in just one moment. Our lines are all filled, but you'll be able to get through eventually. Professor Alexander Lamis is our guest, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. He's a specialist on elections and political parties, author of The Two-Party South, editor of Ohio Politics, and author of Southern Politics in the 1990s. He also taught at the University of Mississippi sometime back. We'll ask him how Mississippi is looking today on the day of their primary. To your calls in a moment. We also have an email. If you'd like to send us a message, you could do that. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to your phone calls, and we start with Mac from Milwaukee. Hi, Mac.
Hey, how you doing there? Hey, I have a couple of points. I mean, well, number one, I don't like this mail. Yeah, it just seems like it's just totally an experiment. And I think with an election this close, we shouldn't be experimenting with anything. I like the fact that I think it was brought up that, you know, we should do this like 50-50 and just seat them. Because rules are rules. They teach us rules. I mean, tax rules, school rules, the rules are rules. And so I don't agree with this. The other thing I like to mention that is not really brought up a whole lot is that I think it's disingenuous, even to your guests as well as to the reporters, that they say that Hillary Clinton won Florida. She was the only one on that ballot. And then the other part of
No, they were all on the ballot in Florida, but nobody campaigned. She was the only one on the ballot in Michigan.
Oh, and in Michigan?
But okay, she has said she's won both of them.
Okay, but this is the last, the point that I want to make, is that they don't really talk about it. You hear it every now and again on the news, but in Florida, the Republicans are the majority down there. And they were the one that actually pushed this. And so, to me, the Republicans have basically made this a mess for the Democrats and a wedge issue. And I do not like the way Hillary Clinton is going about doing this. Because she's just not being honest about the whole situation. Because she's fighting to get that vote.
All right, Professor Lamis.
Yes, well, I think your caller made a couple of good points. And the first one was actually his last point, that Senator Clinton has been dishonest about these two campaigns. And in fact, there's a lot of truth to what he says, and because she capitalized on them for advantage as those results came in, and obscured the fact that as to why others weren't on the ballot and so forth, why it was determined that those votes wouldn't count. So I agree with him completely. But you see, it's a complicated issue, and I would guess a lot of citizens simply don't have the details, don't have command of those details. And then the other point about the Republicans in Florida really causing this train wreck in the Sunshine State, that's not completely accurate, because it is true that the Republicans control the legislature and they have the governorship, and they passed the legislation that did it. But there were a lot of Democrats supporting it, and as I said earlier, Senator Nelson, who's a Democrat, is part of the effort with Senator Levin of Michigan to highlight the flaws in the system and to try to reform the system. So I think really behind the whole Florida-Michigan effort to go first was a fight over the process, and that's been lost, you know, in the fight over the nomination.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say I'm really really sorry that is what has happened, because there really needs to be a good discussion of this process, and I hope out of the struggle will come a commission to look at it. As I said earlier.
Thanks very much for your call, David or Mac. Now we go to David. David from Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
Yeah, I'm from Michigan, so I know all about the whole mess up here.
Uh-huh.
But now it's being focused because it's playing to the candidates that they want Michigan and Florida counted. I mean, they should be focused on the voters, like the superdelegates, they should just give that to whoever gets the most popular vote. As far as this whole thing, they should have a bunch of small states, then followed by regional primaries, then follow up by a final primary where all the big states, they're having at least half the delegates do it. So there always be a chance for the person who sticks in, go for that last big primary where half the delegates are chosen in Florida and California, New York, all the big states count up. So there's always a possibility, you know, so that, you know, those states don't feel like they're being not counted.
Right. You've written about this extensively, Professor Lamas.
Yeah, I mean, that's a neat idea that your caller just expressed. And our idea is that what we should have is a lottery to determine which regions get to go first in the process. And then within those regions, the smallest states, again, by some lottery, rotate as to, you know, who goes in which cycle. Then you have a 16-year cycle where every region gets to go first. And then in the process, you also don't have in the first month that many delegates chosen, say roughly 15%, and then 25% in the next 2 months, and then finally 35% in the final month, which would be along the lines of what, you know, the caller was suggesting. I might just mention that, you know, Allegheny College in Pennsylvania is sponsoring a 2-year program to study the process, and a couple of weeks ago they had a bunch of teams from various colleges come and participate in a competition in which they expressed their various ideas for reforming the process. I took a Case Western Reserve University team there, and there were like I said, about close to 20 teams, and they had a lot of neat ideas, and I'm sure on their website, all these ideas are available. That's, again, Allegheny College in Pennsylvania.
Okay. Can you explain to me, just in a little more detail, who came up with and when they came up with and why they came up with this idea of superdelegates? What purpose was it to serve?
That's a wonderful question. It's one of these, these obscure party efforts that most people don't know about. But when the process was really reformed and opened up after the debacle at the 68 Democratic Convention through the McGovern-Frazier Commission and really led to a massive influx of popular sentiment in selecting of delegates, and that was before the 72 process. And then as that played out over the next couple of cycles, party establishment figures became concerned that they had democratized the process too much and left the party officials out of it. So they established, after the 1980 election, they established another commission called the Hunt Commission, chaired by Governor Jim Hunt of then of North Carolina. And it's out of the Hunt Commission that came this change in the structure to have these superdelegates. And who are they? They are all members of the Democratic National Committee, which is now a lot of people. It's like 400-something people. And all members, Democratic members of Congress and governors, past presidents, and you know that and that sort of thing. It's 795 in this convention, which is 19.6%.
Oh my gosh!
That I think initially it wasn't quite 19.6; it was more like 15%, and then it's expanded, probably because the Democratic National Committee expanded. You know, one reason the Republicans have fewer is their national committee is much smaller. They have the old traditional national committee with 100 members from the 50 states. Usually it's every national committeeman, a national committee woman, and then the 50 state party chairs. So it's 150 plus, maybe an ex-president or two in there. I don't know, but they don't let the Republican members of Congress are not automatically delegates. They have to go win their slots in the process. But anyway, that's how it came up. And as I say, I think all the scrutiny this year is going to come down.
Right. Oh, I think you're right about that. Thanks so much for the call, David. Let's go to Ed from Wausau. Hi, Ed.
Hi. As a political junkie, after taking political science in college, I've been watching a lot of the coverage on C-SPAN and whatever. And one tidbit I picked up was, like in Michigan, Governor Granholm is a Hillary supporter, and she could have, vetoed what the legislature said at some point in time, but didn't. She just let it go. And in Florida, it's true, the Democrats did let it go through their legislature, but it was the bill that went through in Florida was a bill to correct the problem that Florida had with the voting machines. In other words, they wanted a paper receipt, you know, for their vote. And essentially, the Republicans crafted the bill so that the Democrats would have to bounce to an earlier date, even though both parties, both the Republican and Democratic parties, had agreed that no one would move beyond this January or Super Tuesday date or whatever.
Yeah, February 5th.
Right. And but what happened was is the Democrats in Florida went along with it so they could get their paper ballot, and that's why they, you know, voted for it. But then, you know, beyond that, the Republicans punished, you know, like their voters in Florida by only having their vote in Florida count half as much, like in the convention, in their Republican convention. And I guess my question is kind of, you know, both parties had agreed that they would to keep the deadline from getting pushed up and pushed up, you know, for all the states, was they set this rule on, both parties agreed, and both or all the candidates agreed that, you know, because Florida and Michigan, you know, went beyond this date, both the Republicans knew what was going to happen and all the Democratic candidates knew what was going to happen, but yet everything took place. My question is, could the Supreme Court get involved?
Oh, my gosh, no. Oh, please, no. Yeah. I didn't know all those intricacies. That's interesting, Ed. Thanks.
No, I didn't either about the legislation in Florida.
Yeah.
But the caller does mention something we haven't talked about, which is the way the Republicans handle all this. Their rules are set forth in the previous national convention, and they specify that the Republican National Committee cannot change the rules for the next convention in that 4-year period leading up to the convention. So they keep the national convention as the supreme lawmaking body, so to speak. Now the Democrats are different, and that's how all these, you know, a lot of changes occurred in who should go first and all that by vote of the Democratic National Committee. Now what the Republican National Convention did 4 years ago was say that nope, state should hold a process before February 5th, but if a state does go earlier, then that state will lose 50% of its delegation. And, of course, that was a sanction that nobody cared about. They just winked and went on because New Hampshire and Iowa knew they were going to go first anyway, and they didn't care about the 50% because, you know, who cares what the vote is at the convention when the process is determined way before the convention?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think there's a technicality there. They leave Iowa out because the final delegation is not selected until after February, you know, 5th, as the caucus process works its way through the next cycle. But for states that did go earlier, including Florida, and the great, you know, first in the nation New Hampshire primary, half of those elected delegates technically would not count at the convention.
Thank you, Ed, so much for your enlightening call. Kate from Brookfield, hi.
Hi, good morning. I was just thinking, well, first of all, there's an old Will Rogers quote of, I don't belong to an organized party, I'm a Democrat. And then what I was thinking is this is probably the best set of candidates the Democrats have ever seen. And I'm a little afraid if the superdelegates don't vote for the popular candidate, it's going to be the death of the party. I really don't know that we can come back from that. So those were my comments.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Yes, that old Will Rogers line about the Democrats been used a lot.
And it's playing out this
course,
year.
did apply to the Democratic Party of his era, but you know, since the 1920s. Democrats have actually become a more unified party. It It started with the Rooseveltian Revolution, but it really took off with when the with the breakdown of the one-party Democratic South. And now that you have a, you know, back in that old system, all the white people were Democrats to preserve white supremacy. And that really clouded the national picture because the Democrats outside of the South were Democrats for other reasons than that had nothing to do with the segregation in the South. Now that all that has vanished, we really do have a national party system today, and both parties are relatively cohesive, and so even the Democrats are now an organized party, even though, as we've seen, they got some dysfunctional aspects.
Right, yeah. Not organized across the board this year. Thanks, thanks, Kate, very much for your call. We go to Jerry from Minocqua. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thanks,
Jerry. We missed you.
Thank you.
I don't think there's a way of solving the current problem with the two states that will do anything but alienate a bunch of people. And the sooner they get it solved, the fewer people will be alienated. So letting this go a long time is just a bad thing. But the way I would solve the primary issue that I think would be most democratic is to let the primaries run in order of the size of the state, from the smallest to the largest, so that the people with the least, the candidates with the least name recognition would have the best chance in the smaller places where it doesn't cost as much to advertise and get the word out. And I see, it seems to me that would be the fairest, and then spread that out over whatever time frame was appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I mean, that's a neat idea, and that's one that, you know, really ought to be thrown into the mix as people consider how to reform the process. You know, it's interesting, a proposal made by a college team at that Allegheny College event was to order the states based on the turnout percentages in a previous election, so that the state that had the highest turnout would go first. And actually, the college team proposed the turnout in the previous, you know, Democratic primaries. I don't think that was the election you should go for, but rather the turnout in the general election, and to encourage, you know, people to vote. If everyone turns out in Wisconsin, then maybe Wisconsin would be first.
What states would rank way at the top?
Well, I think I don't have it in front of me, but there's clearly that data is available. I think Minnesota, Wisconsin have always been leaders in turnout.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the southern states like Alabama and Mississippi have tended to be lower, but it varies across the country. But it does vary amazingly. I mean, something from, you know, the high 70s down to the low 40s.
Isn't it remarkable how many people have been voting in the primaries, Professor Lamas? It's just extraordinary.
Absolutely. Of course, it's excited the Democratic Party because they've gotten the lion's share of those. But it is exciting, and I think, you know, that that's a good part of the process. And one reason there's this outpouring is, of course, the process has continued. So other states have been able to come into it, and people have seen it as a real horse race in the Democratic Party, and that's energized people. Still hadn't energized everybody. You know, I think the Ohio turnout, for example, was fairly low. I mean, I don't know the exact numbers. The Secretary of State probably put it out around 50%, but they present that number in a misleading way. They always say 50%, but it's really 50% of registered voters opposed to, you know,
voters.
Voting age population.
Any gut feeling on Mississippi today?
Well, I think the patterns that we've seen in these other southern states are likely to hold, and the polls, of course, show the same result. That is that Senator Obama is far ahead, and so he should have a good night. And that's based on the makeup of the party in Mississippi, as was the case in other southern states. I mean, what you have in the Democratic Party there is really a black-white Democratic coalition. There are a lot of blacks in those southern states. Mississippi actually is the leader in that category, you know, this, for historical reasons, going back to the old plantation system. But 35% or so of the population in Mississippi is African American, and there's no reason to think that they won't vote the same way African Americans have voted all over the country, which is about 90% for Senator Obama. And that's a big leg up, and then he's getting a lot of white support as well.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about, and adding on to the conversation a little bit, the Florida and Michigan primaries and how they need to be redone and how they can be redone and whether or not they should be redone and who pays for it and what do you think about it. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Well, and we want to tell you that our guest is Professor Alexander Lamas. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western University. He is also the author of The Two-Party South and editor of Ohio Politics and author of Southern Politics in the 1990s. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Dr. Lee Biblow will be joining us, and I don't often get very personal on this show, but as you know, I had a heart attack. I still can't believe that I had a heart attack not that long ago. And so many of you have written to me and have sent me emails saying, please do a show on cardiac disease and how we can prevent cardiac disease and what we can learn from you. And there are a few things I think that you can learn from me. Some of my bad habits, I hate to admit to, but we will talk about cardiac disease prevention and also treatment. It affects so many people and affects women differently than men. So my cardiologist has kindly agreed to spend an hour with us. And if we can help you, then me telling you about a little bit about my life is worthwhile. So join us for that conversation after 10. Let's go back to phone calls, continuing our I just love these political conversations. What will we do when the election is over? You know, we've been able to do this for such a long time, and it's so fascinating. Let's go to more phone calls for Professor Alexander Lamas. And our next caller is Leslie from Preston, Minnesota. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi. Welcome back.
Thank you, Leslie.
So nice to hear your voice.
Thank you.
I guess my comment about this Michigan and Florida debacle is it just makes me more cynical about the whole process of our government and our legislators, in that it seems like the working man has to follow the rules, but the rich guys can just make up the rules as they go along, and they can make the rules to benefit them once they're in there. And I think the whole idea of all these super delegates was to ensure that one or the other of the parties stays in there and makes it harder for a third party to get in there in the first place. But it just really makes me sick when I think about they can just jack everybody else around and they can do what they want.
Professor Lamas.
Well, there's you know, no doubt about it that that those who are in power tend to fix the system if they can to keep themselves there. We see that in the old redistricting issues, where districts are created for incumbents of both parties, and that's a deal cut state after state. And that's certainly a reform issue that ought to be looked at. And I think stacking the super delegates in a selection process is part of that. And these are all things that are to be fought over in the political process. I mean, people have to stand up and say, we don't like this. This is not the way we would like our democracy run, and work to overturn it, because we do have a process that can be changed if enough supporters are mobilized in various levels of government.
Thanks,
Don.
Some of
those, reform issues are being mentioned, in this campaign.
Yeah, thanks, Leslie. Thanks, Leslie, for calling. We go to Donna now from Green Bay. Hi, Donna.
Hi. What I think is missing when we keep on talking about these superdelegates and having it be the way the people are voting is the fact that the parties are responsible for choosing a candidate that can win in the fall. And what has to translate is our electoral college votes. Like when somebody wins a whole bunch of delegates in a state that's going to be voting Republican, that's going to cancel out with zero electoral college votes in the fall. And so I think that these super delegates are there to try to make sure that whoever is elected is somebody who is going to carry the states that are the blue states or maybe the purple states,
mm-hmm.
so that we can actually win in the fall. And I think somebody needs to evaluate, as these primaries have gone, where, and the other thing is it's winner take all. So if you were to consider, let's say, that Senator Clinton won a state and consider it a winner-take-all instead of parsing out the delegates,
mm-hmm.
You're getting a little bit better picture of what it will be in the fall when we are actually electing our electoral college.
But you would be in favor of our voting, wouldn't you? I mean, we don't want to leave it all up to the superdelegates because they can decide who best could win in the fall.
No, but I think you have to put a greater concentration on those states that are the blue or the purple states.
Okay.
Have a chance. And if the other candidate is winning all of the states that are just red states and will never be blue or purple,
mm-hmm.
then those should not be counted as seriously as the ones that will actually get you the election in the fall.
Okay. What about this? Let's start with a part of her comment that it should be winner-take-all primaries. Why don't the Democrats do that?
Well, I think that's certainly something that ought to be debated. I like the way they do it in the Republican Party a little better. And I might say I'm a Huey Long Democrat, so any praise I have for Republicans is amazing. Mm. But in the Republican Party they have winner take all in many states at the congressional district level.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a fair way to do it. They also have winner take all at the state level in some of their processes, and I'm less enamored with that. But I think one reason the Democrats moved to proportional representation was they felt without it, and this was a decision made back in the late '60s. They felt without it that minority groups, particularly African Americans, maybe Hispanics, might be disadvantaged in winner-take-all at the statewide level. So they probably went way too far, because today we have a lot of districts that have been constructed, congressional districts, to see that there's a majority of Hispanics and African Americans. So that if you had winner-take-all at the congressional district level, you'd avoid that initial problem that you had that led the Democrats to go to proportional representation.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one. I know she had another good point in there.
What was the other point, Donna?
The other point was that the superdelegates are there to make sure that we win in the
fall. Electability, yeah.
The notion that the superdelegates really provide, adult supervision for the process. And,
right.
and that is a good argument. I mean, that is the strongest argument you could make for them. But you have to counter that with the other arguments, and that is the letting voters decide. Now, if you're going to go back to party insiders deciding, really that would take us back to the old nomination system that we had for most of our history. It was certainly in existence when Franklin Roosevelt was nominated in 1932, or Woodrow Wilson, and it only began to change in the 40s and 50s, leading to the big transformation that we talked about already. So I'm not sure, that this country wants to go back to letting party leaders caucus and decide what they think is best for the country.
Thanks, Donna, for the call. We have about a minute left, so, Charlie, we need to be a little quick here. From Dodgeville, hi.
Hi. From my perspective, I don't see any advantage of being an earlier state to have the primary. I went into the booth still not quite certain about Obama. I was leaning towards him. And then after the Wisconsin primary, all the stuff that I kind of felt Hillary would start doing, she started doing it. And all I could think was, thank God I pulled the lever for her, connected the dots, excuse me, for for Obama. I just like the longer I can look at a candidate, the better. I just don't see any advantage of being the first.
Perfect argument for spacing it out over several months.
Yeah. Oh, it's so interesting, isn't it, Professor Lamis? What an election. What an election.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us. Always a great pleasure. We'll talk again.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you.
Professor Alexander Lamis, he is Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western University. He is a native of Charleston, South Carolina, and author of The Two-Party South. He is also the editor of Ohio Politics, and his second book is Southern Politics in the 1990s. We thank him so much for talking to us. And thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee and for all of your great interest in politics. We're all political junkies, are we? I love you. You're so on top of everything. It's great. Thanks for your calls and for your interest in this. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll have another hour that I hope will make us all healthier people. So stay tuned. This is the Ideas Network.